welcome to episode 3 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I am Josh. I don't want to go through the whole bio again. You know, I have some academic stuff and I've been to prison. I'm currently a freelance writer, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. If you're having trouble with addiction, hopefully my book can be of some help to you. If not, feel free to ask me any questions you might have, and I'll try to help. Joel?
And I'm Joel Barson. I come out of the affordable housing world, and I am a friend of Josh.
Yes, indeed, and I'm a friend of Joel's, too. I said this last time, but I'm going to say it again. Thanks to Odonis Odonis for being nice enough to provide us theme music for the show. Again, if you haven't heard them, their last album, No Pop, was pretty highly rated. I've seen them live. They're really great. You can find their music on Spotify, on iTunes, and on Bandcamp, and, of course, in record stores. Also, if you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe. You know, we're on iTunes, we're on Stitcher, and we're on SoundCloud. You can see the show notes every week on my blog, onpiratesatellite.com. That's onpiratesatellite, all one word, .com. We'd love to hear your comments and answer any questions you might have. And, you know, the more you all interact with us, the better this will get. So what do you got, Joel?
Well, speaking of interaction, one way that you and I interact before these programs, Josh, is that you give me homework. And I appreciate that because this is very much a learning process and experience for me. And
well, I think one of the ideas of this is, you know, I've heard so many, and they're very powerful, and I have lots of stories, and we'll get to them. We're kind of in a, we've been in a part of the criminal justice process where it's not so much personal stories as much as information. But kind of my goal with this podcast is to take personal firsthand experiences and storytelling and combine it with kind of the evidence to back a lot of it up. And I think we were just talking a little while ago about I had a conversation online the other day where someone was like, well, I've been doing this for 13 years and I've seen this and this and this. And that's exactly the problem. You know, all of us have anecdotal experience that we can bring to bear, and it is very powerful, and we have seen things in totally different ways. And that's why research is so important, is because the statistics and the data kind of navigate so that the most extreme examples that we've all experienced don't become the main, you know. And so doing the research helps you kind of navigate what really is the truth for the most cases and tries to make sure we get to the best solutions.
I appreciate that so much, Josh, because the reading that I did in preparation for this discussion we're going to have, much like the reading I did in preparation for the other one, helped to bring to light for me how the way I might have intuitively looked at the criminal justice system and about incarceration did not match up with reality and with the facts and with the data and with the statistics. Last time, we were talking about how the assumptions that we would make about violent crime don't really match up to the realities and the data and the innovative ways of looking at violence that can help to address mass incarceration and make our world a better place, a less violent place. And this time, we once again are looking at something that I did not understand well enough. You spoke about anecdotal experience, and my anecdotal experience for what we're going to talk about, which is prosecutors, came from the show Law and Order, which it feels like it's everywhere. You can watch Law and Order 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, it seems. And it creates a perception about what prosecutors do and how they work. And the reading and the real information that's out there tells a different story, and it's a troubling one, and one that I'm glad to understand a little better.
Yeah, I think Law and Order is a great example of kind of like the jumping off point between people who've experienced the criminal justice system on either side and people who haven't. Many people who hopefully are listening to this podcast know that I wrote a series recapping the entire Orange is the New Black series from the perspective of a formerly incarcerated person. So I would go through every episode and kind of explain what stuff was realistic, what stuff wasn't realistic, how it really would play out, and also just make comments about the issues that the show raises, because they raise a lot of issues that actually are germane to what happens in prisons. One of the reasons I picked that show is, of all the shows that I watched, while it has wild inaccuracies, it was still one of the ones that actually tried the hardest to at least both have compassion towards all the people involved and also have some, raise some issues that are really key issues, and not kind of re-victimize or re-oppress anyone in the process. Regardless of what the situation was, re-victimization is a little bit of a weird thing in this area. But if you have had violence in prison, you are a victim of violence in prison. And, you know, a lot of prison shows do kind of present that in a pretty problematic way. And so I think you'd find that, with very few exceptions, most formerly incarcerated people I know, the show they hate the most is Law & Order, because it's one of the most inaccurate.
Well, also, in preparation for this episode, I was watching an interview with John Pfaff. Pfaff or Pfaff?
Pfaff, yeah.
With John Pfaff.
I've never actually asked him.
Yeah, well, in that interview, he talks about, you know, the opening of Law & Order that everybody knows so well, where it says the people are represented by two separate yet equally important groups, the police and the prosecutors, leaving out the entire other part of the population that's impacted by the criminal justice system, which are those who were at the other end of the prosecutor's work, as if they don't exist, as if they don't matter, as if they're not human.
Yeah, which is a pretty normal experience. Even in, you know, when you read criminal justice reform articles from popular sources, you'll often just the last couple, just the other day, a friend of mine, Tara, who is a really nice person who formerly incarcerated, who after she got out really worked her butt off and got herself a law degree. And not only that, became a Skadden Fellow, which is a very hard thing to do, even if you're not a formerly incarcerated person. And so she went through the process of trying to sit for the bar, and the court said she couldn't. And so she challenged that all the way up to the Oregon Supreme Court. Wow. And the Oregon Supreme Court decided unanimously that she should be able to sit for the bar. And the person who actually was her lawyer is a Georgetown law professor named Sean Hopwood, who was also formerly incarcerated. So it was a pretty cool story. And I know Tara personally, and I've talked to Sean a lot. So it was a pretty cool thing. And Sean does a podcast called Prison Professors Podcast. So he's pretty nice guy, too.
Nice.
Yeah. And so anyway, you know, that's an example of, you know, what you were talking about.
So that leads us into our topic for today. And I don't think I would have guessed, Josh, that in thinking about mass incarceration, how much of a factor the prosecutor is. And John Pfaff lays it all out there, saying that they are the single most important factor.
Yeah, and I went back and looked at the original research that he did on this to pull this quote. You know, he actually wrote a book called Locked In that I talked about last week that I think everybody should read. I think if you read what I've said for a while now, when I talk about this stuff, is I think you'll get a really good idea of how the criminal justice system works if you read both Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, and Locked In by John Pfaff. I think between those two books, you'll get a fairly accurate view of the entire system, including both the federal and the state system. Anyway, John Pfaff, in his original research before he published the book and before the stuff you were going to talk about, he said this. I demonstrate that the growth in prison population, you know, using the research that was available, at least during the 1990s and the 2000s, has been driven almost entirely by change in precisely one part of the criminal justice chain, the prosecutor's decision to file a felony claim. During that time, convictions per filing and admissions per conviction appear to be relatively flat, suggesting that it is prosecutors' increased willingness to file charges that are the primary engine of growth.
It's not just their willingness, though, that is a factor in this. It's also the extent of power that they have. I got the impression that they have this silent magisteria of power that was beyond what I had even guessed. And I wonder if you could talk about that.
Sure. It's really kind of unbelievable, and I don't think most people realize this, but first of all, district attorneys in general are elected in safe districts. You know, we'll talk about gerrymandering at some point probably, but that's one, this is one example of how that operates. In fact, one study suggested that between 2004 and 2014, 78% of district attorneys ran unopposed throughout the United States.
That doesn't sound like a bad public office to hold
if
you're concerned about holding your job.
If you want to hold on to your job, being a district attorney is one of the best things you can do. And they also then hire or maintain all the prosecutors below them. And so usually whoever has that post kind of sets the tone for how, you know, the rest of the office is going to work. A second thing that that gives them a lot of power is that DA offices, district attorney offices, are consulted on all legislation dealing with criminal justice reform, and they're often given preferential space to give testimony about legislation to the legislature. This is a much different relationship as someone who does criminal justice reform work that they have compared to what we have. You know, usually we get to testify for a few minutes, you know, as a in part of a gaggle in front of us, in front of the Senate committee on whichever, you know, either the Senate or the House committee on, you know, whatever their name of that is, for just a few minutes, and then pass the buck to another person, pass the buck to another person. The district attorney's office gets as much time as, you know, and as much consultation as they want. And usually the legislation isn't even written without having been, you know, it's it, every stage of the process is consulted with the criminal, with the district attorney's office. And, you know, one of the things people say then, they'll say, oh, yeah, well, maybe that's true, but at least judges, you know, can check district attorneys. That is not necessarily true. A lot of judges are elected, and district attorneys have lobbying organizations. And so state the lobbying organization for state's district attorneys have different names in every state. There's also national ones, and they can lobby against candidates or lobby for candidates. So a lot of times judges are afraid to go against prosecutors or to check prosecutors particularly because they're afraid they'll lose their job. Prosecutors don't have to worry about losing their job for the most part, but judges do, and district attorneys have a lot of power over them. In addition, and I think you were talking to this in a sense about this, and I think this quote's actually even going to mention Law and Order, the public has kind of been trained to love prosecutors. And so even at that, there isn't even a public check on prosecutorial power. This is from Reason magazine. They say, today, American culture remains much more Dirty Harry than Sheriff Taylor. And actually, this is from an article called Confessions of an Ex-Prosecutor. So this is from a prosecutor. When Americans think about criminal defendants' constitutional rights, they may consider the Bill of Rights in the abstract, but they're more powerfully moved by decades of Dick Wolf's Law and Order series and its spinoffs and imitators. Those programs occasionally show a bad cop or a rogue prosecutor or an innocent man railroaded by a dirty prosecution, but those are the exceptions. The overwhelming cultural message from American entertainment is that constitutional rights are barriers to justice, tactically erected impediments that the forces of law and order must overcome to reach resolution in 42 minutes. Real prosecutors watch TV too. They work in the nation that portrays their duties that way, and they enjoy the benefits.
So, that puts a whole new spin on Executive Assistant District Attorney Jack McCoy. You're right, with Law and Order being such a long-standing series and so pervasive, I feel like it seeped into my mind.
Well, and I think another example is The Closer. You know, one of her characteristics throughout the series, and she paid a little bit of a price for it at the last season, but most of it was finding ways to kind of break the law, in a sense, to turn the law against itself so she wouldn't have to recognize constitutional rights or the right way to interrogate. She'd find ways to break the system in order to get what she needed to, you know, incarcerate prisoners, I mean, incarcerate accused criminals.
So in one of the articles that we read, John Pfaff says that prosecutors, unfortunately, don't seem to want to be part of the process of looking at the impact that they are having on mass incarceration. Rather, quote, they are all too often a roadblock to significant reforms. So I wonder if you could talk about the impact that prosecutors have on changing the system.
Well, we talked a lot about this the last time in terms of putting in carve-outs and things like that. Both legislators and district attorneys like to have these kind of carve-outs that keep whole categories of people who are either, you know, from criminal justice reform. But another, there's a few, I think, fairly legitimate reasons. You can understand where they're coming from on some of them. I'm not saying that they work out in the best possible way or that they're the right way to be, but you can see where they're coming from. I think one of those is that prosecutors are literally around nothing but awfulness all the time. They see the absolute worst. You can, every bad moment people have ever, everything every anyone's ever done that's terrible, they've seen. And then when they finish that case, they go on to the next case, and they go on to the next case, and they go on to the next case. And so they never really, all they see is a never-ending stream of awfulness. And so, you know, they don't really spend a lot of time with the people who, you know, got off, or the people who never got to that point of the prosecution, or the people who then, you know, get out and succeed wildly in life or make huge differences to make the world a better place. All they see is a never-ending stream of awfulness. And so to their mind, every single person is a guilty person, and every single person deserves massive punishment. And so they don't start out from a place where they have much compassion or empathy. And you can understand that because their job is set up in such a way that they don't ever get to see the good side of any of that. So I think that's, you know, that's a fairly, you know, I think you can see where they're coming from on that. I don't think, you know, we'll talk about research and stuff like that as we always do, but that's a good, you know, starting point from their perspective. The second thing is that all of their incentives are built around successful prosecutions and convictions. In other words, how you're judged as a prosecutor is not by how well someone turns out at the end of their criminal journey or their criminal justice system journey. It's by if the prosecutor got a conviction or if they successfully prosecuted the case. And so it's really not about outcomes in the way that we'd probably think of them. It's about outcomes in terms of convictions. A third one, I think, is that, I've read stuff from former prosecutors who talk about really, and I take their at their word, I don't think this is a hyperbole, that they spend a lot of their time just terrified that if they're even remotely, you know, empathetic or try to cut, you know, make things easy on anyone, that that person is going to turn around and go out and commit, you know, terrible crimes in their community. And then, you know, when someone asks them, you know, why didn't you stop this person? They don't really have a good answer to it. They were just trying to be empathetic. That's not, you know, that's, they want to protect their, and I, you know, that's, there's definitely some truth to that. I don't, you know, I understand where they're coming from. Another example is that they have they need to have large caseloads, and they have to have a lot of people in the system, because if they don't, then the plea bargaining system stops to work. And we'll probably do a whole episode on plea bargaining because it's a huge part of how the criminal justice system works. And why it's so important is because over 90% of all cases are resolved through a plea bargain. And it has been hypothesized, I know it was definitely in Michelle Alexander's book, that if everyone in the criminal justice system refused to take plea bargains, the entire system would collapse. Because they have so few cases that actually go to court, that's why the system is able to continue. And if you have less total cases in the system, then, you know, the whole justification for all of that working, or the whole way that all of that works, probably doesn't work anymore. And we've talked already about groupthink, which, you know, I mean, they have, because they're all around all this awfulness all the time, and every one of them knows every other one of them, and they're kind of in a bunker mentality together, they kind of come to this point where they all just think that every person needs to have the book thrown at them. And I know this somewhat from personal experience, because one of my ex-girlfriends was a death penalty prosecutor, and when I got out of prison, we had a lot of conversations, we would have pretty vociferous disagreements based on, you know, what I consider to be, you know, she probably looks at it a little differently, this phenomenon of prosecutorial groupthink.
Wow. I want to ask you more about that at another time, Josh.
Sure.
But one of the things you said, I'd actually like to go back to. You
sure.
Said that all of the prosecutors' incentives are built around successful prosecutions and convictions. not by implication on reducing crime or making our society safer?
Well, I think they would say that ultimately the idea is to reduce crime and make society safer, but the way that they go about that is by trying to put more people in prison. And what we've found out, hopefully, over the first 2 weeks is that putting more people in prison doesn't make society more safe. And so they're so kind of sucked into the front end that they don't see the whole picture, or they just have no interest in knowing anything other than... It's kind of like, you know, like if you've ever watched the series The Wire, which is one of my all-time favorite series, it's kind of about the kind of inertia that's created by bureaucracy, and you're so... incentivized and built into the system that you participate in, even if you see the injustice or the problems in the system, you just have too much incentive to keep working in that system to ever really work for change, which I think is some of what we're...
It also makes me think of one of the articles that you sent to me called The Innocence Deniers by Laura Bazelon, and this was in Slate magazine about a week ago. And in that article... she quotes the Supreme Court case, Berger versus the United States, where it says that the Supreme Court said that the prosecutor's ultimate goal should not be to win a case, but to see that justice should be done. And she discusses how justice is sometimes at odds with the prosecutor's incentive to always have successful prosecutions and convictions.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true.
That focuses on winning instead of... doing what's right, or maybe like we talked about last episode, restorative justice, where communities can be healed.
Yeah, and you talked about, I think earlier before this started, we were talking, and you said something about a particular anecdote or case that had spoken to you or something like that in the reading.
Well, in this Laura Bazelon article, I'd actually suggest that people read it, because it's striking not just the degree... that in some cases prosecutors will go to seek a win over what appears to be just, but how hard they will fight against mounting and in some cases insurmountable evidence that someone is innocent to maintain a conviction, because it seems like there is so much inertia in favor of winning and prevailing versus seeing that justice is done, and in some cases, seeing that innocent people go free.
Yeah, I do want to make one caveat here. And I do care deeply about people who are innocent in prison and people who are innocent in jail, that they get out. That's something that I think we all think that, you know, better a thousand, what is the old saying, better a thousand guilty people go free than one innocent person's in prison. I believe that. I don't know if everybody believes that. I think that no one should ever have to suffer the bondage of incarceration when they haven't done anything. But the vast majority, the overwhelming majority, and I've seen it, you know, I would say the vast majority of everyone I ever met in prison was guilty of something. Okay, that doesn't mean they were guilty of everything that they were charged with. It doesn't mean that everything was fair. It doesn't mean that nothing was wrong about their prosecution. But at the bottom of all of it, they were probably guilty of... In my experience, they were guilty of something. I was guilty of something. You know, and you know, a lot of the healing that occurs, you know, restorative justice is, you know, one of the things that's important about that is coming to grips with what you've done. You know, and so I am with a lot of people in the idea that, you know, part of it is it's not what I'm trying to get at is we don't have to, in my opinion, we don't have to focus. I don't think the important thing in trying to reform the criminal justice system is focusing on innocence.
It would seem that innocence are the low hanging fruit. It's sort of obvious. Everybody would get that. There's really no one who would be out there saying, yes, innocent people should be in jail. But if people really are concerned about mass incarceration, about addressing the structural reasons, the inequities in the system, the innocents aren't the place to focus on, it would seem.
Right, although they definitely should get relief. That's not my, no but fish. There are people
yeah.
working on that.
Right.
You know, the point is you're not going to fix the system. If you let every person who is literally innocent out of prison, we would still have a massive mass incarceration problem. I mean... that's, you know, maybe I'm in every, I just did nothing I've seen suggests that there's a huge, massive amount of people who are innocent in prison. That doesn't mean that any innocent person should stay in prison. I'm saying that for criminal justice reform to work and to reduce mass incarceration, we have to be concerned not just with innocent people, but with the vast majority of people who are in prison who, you know, have committed a crime.
So bringing us back to the prosecutor, it seems like we should talk about how we can address some of these issues, but before we get to that, one of the other striking things that came up in the reading for me from John Pfaff was how we have multiplied our number of prosecutors and the impact that the sheer increase in number has had. He actually calls the issue with prosecutors and its impact on mass incarceration a human resources problem. Did you come across that?
Sure. I mean, again, this is tied to budgets, right? The more prosecutors you have, the more your budget increases, the more cases you could try, the more the system works. You know, I don't want to sound conspiratorial, but it does all work together. There is a logic to it.
Right. There are people there working. You want to keep them employed. It sort of makes sense. The police are still bringing cases to them, but there are many more prosecutors to take those cases, and so there's a lot more machinery to send folks to jail, it would seem.
Yeah, and you know, we'll talk about this at a later date too, but one of the things that's striking about that is the difference between the resources that a prosecuting district attorney's office gets statewide compared to the indigent defense office, which, you know.
Right. Yeah, that came up as well, as did the impact of local prosecutors sending people to state prisons where the budgets are completely separate. Local prosecutors don't have to worry about state budgets and how that factors in as well.
Yeah, for sure.
So, Josh, if there are any prosecutors listening right now, they might eagerly want to know how they can improve the system.
No, they probably want to throw things at me right now. I understand some of their perspective. Hopefully you'll hear me talk about things in the abstract, like prosecutors and eventually correctional officers we'll talk about a bit. I do want to foreground that there are definitely very good people who do both jobs. There are people who I respect immensely for their professionalism that I ran to when I was in prison who were officers. But there's also a lot of people I didn't respect so much. So, you know, we'll talk about all of that. But yeah, how do we address the problem? Okay, well, the first one, and I think this is the most important one, and this is a theme we'll return to over and over again throughout our discussions, is the notion of outcome-based reform. And in this instance, what I mean is that prosecutors should be judged and funded not by conviction numbers, but by reducing mass incarceration, successfully addressing racial disparities, and reducing recidivism. And I especially want to talk about the second one there. Obviously, the problem with structural sentencing racism problems is mostly based in charging and sentencing. And that is overwhelmingly controlled by prosecutors. And so what I mean is, you know, for instance, in drug offenses, you have people who get, you know, say a white person does cocaine and a black person does crack. The black person who does crack is more likely to be sentenced and more likely to be sentenced for a lot of time and convicted, I mean, than a white person. That's just factually correct. The same people do the same crime. There's totally different outcomes. And part of that's on prosecutors. And so not only do they need to make sure that their outcomes are reducing mass incarceration and reducing recidivism, and that's what they should be judged on, but it is very important in all areas of criminal justice reform that we always make sure that addressing racial disparity is part of it, because that should be unacceptable in our society, in my mind.
So I'd be interested, Josh, in peeling that back just a little bit, because I feel like as a culture, I hear more and more about exactly the statistics you just said in terms of these racial disparities. I would imagine that prosecutors hear this all the time. And, you know, given that they must be aware of these statistics, is it possible that they're not working on that?
Well, they're not, because the results aren't changing. You know, I would like to think that they are. But, you know, if you're held to a standard of you can't keep charging people at a different rate for the same crimes, and you have to, and your budget is determined by if you meet those goals, then I'm guessing they're going to change a little bit more than if you just leave it to their discretion.
Right.
And there's no reason why it could be logical.
Right.
You know, I mean, we talked about this last a couple times ago when this notion of inherent criminality in communities of color, that's just not true. You know, we've talked about the anecdotal, you'll hear people give their anecdotal examples. Oh, well, I know, blah, 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 blah. But that's just the research just doesn't bear it out. And so we have to start calling people on it straight up. We have to start saying, you can't do this anymore.
So that's the solution. Are there any other solutions?
Sure. You know, transparency is a pretty good thing. I mean, one of the things that John Pfaff talks a lot about, sorry, this is just an area he specializes in, which is why we're talking about him more than probably anyone else, is that, and other people that I really respect write about this a lot too, that the entire criminal justice system, but a particular prosecutors, are kind of a closed black box. So Pfaff says the results in the same paper we were talking about a second ago clearly indicate that prison admissions rather than time served have been the primary driver of prison growth, and that at least since the 1980s, the main force behind rising admissions has been felony filings. And they provide a clear indication of what we need to focus our attention on. Unfortunately, they imply that we need to focus our attention on the least transparent part of the criminal justice system, prosecutors' offices, and to a large extent, empirical black boxes. In other words, they don't ever give any information. There's no way to study what they do. And so we can't tell them how best to make, you know, they don't let us study them. So we don't know how to fix them, which I think, you know, I mean, if we can make them more transparent, kind of, you know, in the same sense that, you know, most state governments have to follow a FOIA process. There's usually independent people who can look at their records to determine what happened. There could be academic research done, things like that.
So you're saying they need to go from being empirical black boxes to glass houses?
Yes, and I think, one of my favorite people, Heather Ann Thompson, who won the Pulitzer for Blood in the Water last year, which is a history book about the Attica riots. She's a historian. One of her biggest things is making sure the entire criminal justice system is transparent. And I think, you know, making prosecutors' offices and prisons and all these things would be great. But, you know, the first thing we talked about is really pretty revolutionary. You know, I mean, that for so long we've based everything in prisons and jails just on if you're successfully prosecuting or if you're successfully housing. Did someone get their food? You know, I mean,
right.
Those don't help society. Those metrics don't make the situation better. And their job, as you said earlier, if they really were to admit it, is to make society safer. And so their job should be judged on making society safer, and just getting convictions doesn't make society safer.
And this is where I would imagine this is exactly the point where restorative justice, specialty courts, and things like that can be a way for prosecutors to channel their energy and still stay busy from the human resources standpoint, actually improving things.
Yeah, and it would be really good if we maybe did have a smaller, you know, criminal justice system in so many ways, because, you know, think of all the things that we could put money into instead of prosecuting crime.
Right.
You know, just that might make crime lower, you know, these like reducing poverty or having better schools
or better mental health treatment.
Or, you know, all of these things. You know, people tend to focus on the cost of prisons when there's a lot of other elements that need to be. It's not just, and they usually look at that as cost per prisoner. But the real cost of prison, for instance, of prisons, as has been demonstrated by studies, is the cost of administration and the cost of officers and the cost of the facilities, not the cost of the prisoner themselves, although the prisoner cost is high. But comparatively, over 60% of the cost is those things that I just mentioned. And that's probably true of prosecutors' offices, too. If we had a much leaner prosecutor's office and we had a lot more diversion and we had a lot more, we'd have a lot more money to put into other places like education, like mental health treatment, like ending poverty in our cities, in our towns. I think those would all be better than what we're doing now.
Makes sense to me. Sounds like this is another critical area for people to focus on and educate themselves about.
Yeah, and hopefully, you know, some prosecutors might get on board with us. I doubt it, but maybe. Well, I can always hope.
But they're most invited to engage on all the platforms where Decarceration Nation appears, right?
Yeah, and I mean, just the other day I had a long conversation with someone who's in bail bonds who was really upset with one of our first episode, and I talked to him all day because it was a respectful conversation, and, you know, he had some interesting things to say. So, okay, on the next episode, hopefully I'll be conducting an interview with Lauren Brooke Eisen of the Brennan Institute, who's the author of Inside Private Prisons, so we'll be probably talking about private prisons. She's also one of the people responsible for coming up with the concept behind what has become the Reverse Mass Incarceration Act. She wrote the kind of pamphlet that suggested that whole thing many years ago. So I'm really looking forward to that. She's very, very, very cool person, very smart, really. Has come up with some really innovative solutions, so I'm excited about that. Remember, if you did you have anything else, Joel? Or
no, I was just gonna say thank you, Josh, for continuing to make this such an educational and also interesting, challenging, stimulating experience. I look forward to my homework for the next episode.
Great. Remember, if you like the podcast, give us a like, leave a comment, do whatever you can do, do a little dance around the different platforms that we exist on, and feel free to ask any questions. We'll do our best to answer them. And as always, a set of notes with citations for all the stuff that was covered will be available on onpiratesatellite.com. Once again, that's onpiratesatellite.com. And thanks for listening. Hope to talk to you soon.